Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich, and thank you for your contribution to this radio program and to your community radio station. And in return for that contribution, this is our thank you gift to you, the Letters and Politics Ancient History Pack. And we're going to begin this pack with the series that we did on Rome, from Republic to Empire. Now, in reading the notes from the debates at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787, one might think what the Constitution's framers were arguing about was ancient Rome. And they were basing their arguments and theories over the formation of a new government off the old Roman Republic that existed between years 280 BC and 44 BC, a period of 236 years. Now, the United States Republic itself is 242 years, just to give a little perspective. Now, if one reads the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers that were both for and against ratifying the U.S. Constitution, one would see that figures like James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and George Mason never signed their writings with their actual real names, but with pen names frequently from the ancient world, names such as Cicero, Cato, Brutus, and many others. Now, the framers of the Constitution, however, were not just trying to replicate the political systems of the ancient world, but to build off of them in a way that would keep a republic from dissolving into chaos, because that's exactly what happened to the Roman Republic, that would allow for the rise of a strong-armed emperor and an empire that would persist in one manner or another for an additional 1,500 years. So with that in mind, today we begin our series, Ancient Rome from Republic to Empire. And we do it with Edward J. Watts. Edward J. Watts holds the Alcibiades Vassiliades Endowed Chair and is also a professor of history at the University of California, San Diego. And he is the author of the book, Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny. Edward Watts, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to our radio program.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
So let's begin by talking about what a republic even is and what it means. How do you see what a republic is? How do you define a republic?
Yeah, I think that the most important thing for everyone to understand in a modern context is a republic is a representative democracy. And what that means in a big picture way is that it's different from a pure democracy. It's different from, say, the Athenian democracy of the 5th century BC, where every citizen who had a vote would get together, they would vote, and a simple majority would decide how the state would respond to a particular situation or what policies it would implement. And in a republic, the system works differently. What individual citizens do is they elect representatives who collectively serve to represent the voice of the people for a specific amount of time. And then when that time is up, there is another election and more representatives are chosen, or potentially the same people are brought back to serve as representatives again. But the basic idea of a republic is that it should generate consensus, and it should generate, ideally, something like a supermajority for every policy that it pursues. And the reason for that is republics are designed to be more deliberative than democracies. When you look at a pure democracy, what you see is the decisions are made quickly, but the state is incredibly dynamic. And so it can make decisions and then reverse those decisions very, very quickly, almost a sort of whiplash-inducing politics. And a republic is designed to move more slowly so that the decisions that are made generate very broad support. And the state can move forward without continually going back and revising positions and policies that it has set up. And so the basic idea in a republic is that the society prefers to move slowly to make decisions, and it also prefers to make no decision instead of making a decision that has a very narrow base of support. And when a republic is functioning well, it generates consensus and compromise and builds progressively towards policies that the entire society more or less endorses, or at least as close to the entire society as you can reasonably get. And so what that means is these societies are not as dynamic as pure democracies, but the policies and decisions they make tend to be more binding and people feel more invested in them. And so a republic prizes stability over dynamism to a degree.
It can also be frustrating, right? Because things can change slowly.
Yeah, and that's the big problem that you face in a republic like Rome or even a republic like the United States now. When society is changing very quickly, a republic doesn't move as fast as society can change because it needs to build a consensus behind the policies that it wants to enact. And when it does enact those policies, these policies tend to be broadly supported. I think a good example of that is something like Social Security. Where there was a broad base of support for Social Security when it was implemented, and that policy has remained in place for over 80 years because of that. Obamacare was not put in place with such a strong mandate that covered so much of the political spectrum, and therefore it's less stable. There's more willingness and perhaps desire to try to reverse that policy because it wasn't put in place with a consensus backing it. And the challenge in a republic is when society is developing quickly, when, for example, new technology is creating mechanisms to generate wealth much more quickly than normal, there are stresses in the society that a republic really struggles to respond to because the citizens of that republic expect a problem to be dealt with much faster than the republic is sometimes capable of doing. A consensus solution to something like wealth inequality is very difficult to find. And citizens can tend to get frustrated in the time it takes a republic to reach that kind of solution. And that's one of the big risks that republics encounter, one of the big challenges they encounter.
Looking at the Roman Republic, and there was a Roman civilization, a Roman society before the Republic would begin. Rome did have kings previously. When do you say the Roman Republic began? Is 280 BC about right?
So there are different phases of the Roman Republic. I think what's important, and I think it's sometimes amazing for us in a modern context to think about, is the Roman state actually survives for about 2,200 years.
Yeah.
It starts as a monarchy in around 750 BC, and it ends as an empire that's captured by the Ottomans using cannons and gunpowder in 1453 AD. And in between, there are many phases of political development in Rome. But the first phase is this monarchy. And then around 509 BC, the monarchy is overthrown and the republic is set up. The republic is a dynamic, it's a dynamic enterprise and a dynamic institution that evolves progressively over time to become more inclusive and more responsive. But by the time you get into the 280s BC, the republic has taken the form that it will more or less maintain for 200 odd years. It will be more or less as it was in the 280s until it collapses into the dictatorship and the tyranny of Augustus.
Tell me the story about what happens in 280 BC. It seems like this is a foundational story on the Republic itself. Tell me the story about Pyrrhus, Appius Claudius, and Gaius Fabricius Lucinus.
So this is an incredible story. Pyrrhus of Epirus is a descendant of Alexander the Great. He's a relative of Alexander the Great. And Rome, in the period when Alexander's empire is dissolving, Rome manages to achieve domination of nearly the entire Italian peninsula. And around 280 BC, Rome comes into conflict with the city of Tarentum in southern Italy. And the city of Tarentum is actually quite alarmed because Rome is large, it's powerful, and Tarentum by itself can't really confront Rome. And so it invites in Pyrrhus of Epirus, and he comes with a professional army, he comes with elephants, and he begins fighting the Romans. And the Romans have a citizen army, basically draftees. They are not professional soldiers. And Pyrrhus inflicts a really significant defeat on the Romans. But the Romans fight hard. And the Romans, even though they've never confronted an elephant before, they hold their ground and they inflict losses on Pyrrhus that are difficult for him to take. And so what Pyrrhus does is he offers very generous peace terms to the Romans. In effect, the Romans have to admit that Pyrrhus has beaten them, but there's not much else that they have to grant to Pyrrhus other than a return to the status quo before Pyrrhus arrived. And the Roman Senate thinks about this, and many people in the Senate think this is a good deal. You know, they have lost the battle. They don't really know how to fight elephants. And the general trend in the Senate is to approve this and have Pyrrhus go away. And then Appius Claudius, who is an old, grizzled, well-established Roman politician, comes into the Senate. He's, you know, he's crippled. It's very difficult for him to move. And he makes a speech where he says to Romans, if you don't stand your ground and you don't stand up to Pyrrhus, everyone else in Italy will take note of the fact that you were defeated and your domination of Italy will be threatened. And that's going to mean that Rome has to assume certain costs. That's going to mean that Rome is going to have to commit to fighting this war. But for us to be safe as a society, we have to be willing to assume those costs. And if we don't, we should very well understand that we are going to be threatened and our people who are our adversaries are not going to take us seriously. And the Roman Senate decides to continue pursuing the war with Pyrrhus. The situation with Fabricius involves Pyrrhus summoning another member of the Roman Senate and trying to bribe him and use the bribery to try to induce Rome to come to some sort of an agreement that, again, will preserve Pyrrhus's forces. And what Fabricius says is, in some ways, the personal corollary to the social argument that Appius Claudius made. What Fabricius says is, what makes me valuable in my society is my achievements in the Republic and in the service to the Republic. And if I am to take your bribes or I'm willing to take your wealth, that undermines everything that I've achieved in my life, and it undermines everything that my family in previous generations have also achieved. And there's no price that I can put on my honor and the honor of my family. And so what Pyrrhus ends up having to do is fight another battle with the Romans. The Romans also lose that battle, but again, inflict massive losses on Pyrrhus. And what Pyrrhus realizes is the Romans can replace their troops indefinitely, because Rome is invested in fighting this war with them. Appius Claudius has created a very strong sense in Rome that this war is valuable, it's important, and Romans need to fight for their society. And Pyrrhus cannot replace troops as quickly as the Romans can. And so even though Pyrrhus has won two victories against the Romans, he's forced to withdraw. And Rome ends up the victor in the war, even though Rome didn't defeat Pyrrhus in either of those two battles. And so this is where the term Pyrrhic victory comes from.
Huh.
Rome is able to exact such a cost that the victory was, in a sense, worse for the victor than it was for the vanquished.
Pyrrhus victory. Some may say that about Iraq today in the United States. And the story of Fabricius is very important because what it demonstrates is this ideal of the highest honor someone could have is loyalty to the Republic itself, even though, and that's what he chooses, say, over all the gold and silver that Pyrrhus is offering him.
Yeah, and that's the value that Romans felt all Romans should hold forth as the thing that guides their conduct. Service to Rome should come before wealth. It should come before honors. It should come before anything else that a person might decide to pursue in a public way. And what Fabricius embodies is this commitment to honorable service to Rome on the terms that Rome sets. And the great success of the early Republic and the Republic through even the middle decades of the 3rd century BC is that the thing that's most valuable to Romans, to elite Romans who are serving and commanding in Rome, is a quality that the Republic has a monopoly on. You know, the idea of honor and recognition in the terms that Rome sets, the Republic sets those terms. And anything that you might aspire to accomplish as someone who is important or wealthy or from an old family, the Republic decides whether you succeed or fail in accomplishing that. And so that monopoly on what's valuable to Romans provides a really strong check on the kinds of behavior that Romans will undertake in that period. Because in a sense, if you do something that goes against the interests of the Republic, you will not get the sorts of things that are valuable to you and that Rome and Roman society determines to be valuable, because the Republic has a monopoly on those things and their allocation.
This is a period of time that's also known that we see what's called the conflict of orders. What was that?
So that's a really interesting, and I find for my students, a really challenging thing to think about. In Roman society, when the Republic is set up, political power was restricted to people who belonged to a set of aristocratic families, and these are called the patricians. Now, this was a set of aristocratic families that was determined purely by birth. And so patricians were, on the average, richer than non-patricians, which Romans called plebeians. But your membership in this particular order wasn't determined by your wealth. And there were a lot of plebeians who were wealthier than many patricians, but they couldn't become patricians. And the conflict of the orders is, in a sense, a conflict between the wealthy and powerful plebeians who cannot get political power in the state because people who belong to a hereditary aristocracy are monopolizing it. And when the Republic is set up in 509 BC, political power is almost exclusively allocated to patricians on the basis of their birth and the family they came from. And over the course of those 200 years, what we see is a chipping away so that influential and wealthy plebeians get an increasing share and increasing access to positions of power in the Republic. But what's challenging for us is the patrician-plebeian divide is not a class divide. Hmm. It's a divide of orders, of social structures based on heredity, not wealth. And for us, in a modern context, that's very hard to get our minds around. But what we see there is there are really two types of power in the Roman Republic, in the early Roman Republic. There's hereditary power, and then there's economic and social power. And the conflict of the orders is an attempt to preserve some of the prerogatives of hereditary power while also accommodating the power that belongs to people who have wealth or social capital, but don't have descent from an aristocratic family.
If one looks at history, not so unusual to have that dynamic. I think if we look at the formation of, even before this period, of Greek democracy, that was the issue. You had this hereditary power, and then the wealthy and the people who were successful in business and saying, we want a slice of the pie, we want to be able to govern as well. And that's how you start to get the formation of democracy, I guess, with the reforms from Solon. If you even look at, say, the French Revolution or even the American Revolution, it could be argued that these were actually revolutions based on the aristocrats wanting some power as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And the interesting thing is a republic particularly lends itself to that type of conversation. In Greece, when you get a democracy, what's interesting about that is that the power actually isn't confined to people who are economically prosperous or possess some sort of social capital. It's actually a purely majority system in which regular people's vote actually matters quite a bit. But in a republic, the system is in a way stacked so that the votes of certain people matter more than the votes of other people. And we, of course, see this in the United States, where in a presidential election, our vote in California matters something like 1/60th of the vote for somebody in Wyoming. It's designed. It's not a flaw in the system. It's a design of the system. And when you have a system where people with economic and social capital are trying to find a place in a system that has traditionally rewarded aristocratic families, they don't actually want to share whatever power they're able to accumulate with regular people who don't have wealth or social capital. And a republic is particularly well designed to give those wealthy people more of a voice than the people who don't have that wealth. And in the United States, of course, we see that when the initial right to vote is confined to property holders. This was, of course, not a flaw, but a design. And it was very deliberately put in place so that the prerogatives of governance would be confined to a certain level of society, and people without a certain level of wealth didn't have the ability to participate fully.
Let's talk about the structures of a republic. And if we talk about the structures of our own republic, you just look at the checks and balances that we find in the United States Constitution. We have a White House, which we call the executive branch. We have Congress, which is the legislative branch. And then we have the judicial branch that is headed by the Supreme Court. And as we know, those all serve as a check and balance upon one another, at least when they are operating in a good way. In the Roman Republic, and I think there are more than the four I have listed here, but the ones that I have listed here are the consuls, which I guess in some ways is like a president, but not exactly. The tribunes, which is someone who is supposed to represent the people. In fact, I even think the word tribune means protector of the people. So when you see a newspaper call itself a tribune, that's sort of the root word there. Consilium plebis. And then, of course, most people have heard about the Roman Senate. But there are more than just those four, right?
In Rome, I think if you were to talk about the branches of government, you would talk about the assemblies. So the Consilium Plebis is an assembly of only plebeians. There is a popular assembly. There's also a very old assembly that's based on more or less the amount of wealth that people have as allocated to or as divided based on the type of equipment they could provide in military campaigns. And that's largely outdated by the third century, though it's still in use. The Senate is an assembly made up of ex-magistrates. And so they're not directly elected. They are, in a sense, people who used to hold power in the state. And so that would be, in a sense, the legislative aspects of the Roman Republic. And then you have the office holders. And those would be more or less people who propose laws to the legislative assemblies, but also people who execute those laws. And so the consuls are the people, they're the supreme magistrates in the Roman state, and they're the people who execute those laws. The judicial system in Rome is different than what you have in the United States, because prosecutions were initiated by individuals. And our judicial system as an independent branch of government actually provides a much more effective check on misconduct than what the Romans had. And so in that sense, it's an improvement. But if you look at the consuls and other offices in Rome, I think one could argue that the executive offices in Rome probably are an improvement over what we have, at least in terms of generating consensus and preventing the usurpation of power by an individual. Because every magistracy in the Roman Republic is a paired magistracy, which means there's at least two people who hold that position as well, and they can effectively veto the actions taken by each other. And so there are two consuls, and they do serve in a way the same purpose as a president, in a fashion. But they can counteract each other so that neither one of them can do something like usurp power for himself. His colleague can immediately do things to block that if he were to try that. And so in that sense, I think the principle in the executive branch, if we were to call it that, for the Roman Republic, it actually provides much stronger checks on overreach and assertion or usurpation of power than we have in our system.
Yeah, it sounds quite foreign for us today to say have two presidents, but it would actually, as you say, it forces them to find compromise between each other. Could you have two consuls who are just on the same page on most things politically, or do you find that they usually differed and kind of came from different positions?
There are moments where you do get people who are basically governing as a team, but usually the idea, and usually the way that these things would play out, is you would have a consular election, and if it became clear that one candidate was likely to win, and this was a candidate who was in some ways disquieting or concerning to other people, you might have the other candidates kind of band together to try to block him. And this happened when Cicero was running for the consulship. There were two other people running, and they created an alliance to try to stop Cicero from becoming consul, and it didn't work. In other cases, you might have a clear idea that one other person should be in as the other consul when someone has been elected. And so when Julius Caesar was elected consul for the year 59, the senator Cato, who really very strongly opposed Julius Caesar, ensured that his son-in-law Bibulus was also put in as consul with the hope that Bibulus could block Julius Caesar and more or less neuter any actions that Julius Caesar would take that Cato didn't feel good about. In the end, neither one of those arrangements worked. Cicero was elected consul, and Julius Caesar managed to just kind of run over Bibulus. But you do see these actions to try to make the checks within that system work more effectively if there is someone who's running for consul that you're concerned about.
The tribunes are interesting. And again, here, actually, unfortunately, it doesn't exist anymore, but we used to have the Oakland Tribune newspaper. You have the Chicago Tribune newspaper. This word tribune comes from the Roman Republic. This was a position that was supposed to be considered the protectorate of the people, somebody who represented the actual people themselves. We would get this position of tribune as part of the Roman Republic because of the struggles from what was considered, what you talked about earlier, conflict of the orders.
Yeah, and this is one of the very earliest parts of the conflict of the order was the creation of the tribune. When the Republic was set up and it was dominated by patricians, it very quickly became clear to plebeians that that was a tremendous power imbalance and also something that wasn't particularly sustainable in the long term. And so in the first outbreak, really, of political turmoil following the creation of the Republic, plebeians walked out, more or less walked out of the city of Rome and created this magistracy to protect the interests of plebeians. And I think it's important to understand that the people doing this must have been wealthy plebeians and they must have been important plebeians. And they did this to protect their own interests. But the tribune was given the power to literally stand between any patrician and any plebeian who is being mistreated by that patrician. And to make sure that they were able to perform this duty, they were given something called sacrosanctity, which meant, in essence, you would be struck down if you did violence to a tribune. And this is something that more or less stands unchallenged for almost 400 years. So there isn't violence against a tribune for almost 400 years after this institution is created. But the important element of the tribunate was these were the individuals who quite literally stood forward and protected plebeians against any possible overreach by patricians running the Republic. And over time, that idea of physically intervening to prevent mistreatment expands into a kind of legislative mandate so that if one did expect some sort of social reform or economic reform that would benefit the regular people, it was much more likely to come from a tribune because they understood their mandate over time to have expanded into something where they protected not just the physical bodies of plebeians who were threatened by patricians, but also the interests of plebeians, both individual and collective. And so when the Republic, as the Republic evolves, the tribunes become these legislative protectors of the interests of the common people. But they, of course, also had to work within this consensus-building framework. And what the Republic comes to realize is this is a very effective tool for generating discussions that might lead to consensus policies that can fix social problems and political problems, including political inequality and economic inequality. And for much of the Republic, that process does move deliberately, and it does result in consensus and compromise around solutions that benefit all Romans. And so overall, what you see with the tribunate is an office that starts as something that has a relatively limited remit, but becomes very, very important for the functioning and the dynamic evolution of the republic over time.
This is Letters in Politics, and we're in conversation with Edward J. Watts, who's a professor of history at the University of California, San Diego, author of the book Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny. That is what we are talking about. Edward Watts, this is the Roman Republic that we would have going into sort of the next big story, real important period of time that would last about 120 years or so. And that's what's known as the Punic Wars, I guess, roughly from 264 BC to 146 BC. The Punic Wars is three wars over that period of time against Carthage, which you'd find in North Africa, sort of modern day Lebanon today. And Carthage is really the power of the Mediterranean world at this time, as we are watching the ascent of this Roman Republic.
Yeah, in the same way, if you're thinking of Greek history, you're thinking of Athens versus Sparta. If you're thinking of Roman history in this central part of the Roman Republic, you're thinking about Rome versus Carthage. And the relationship between Rome and Carthage was both very longstanding. One of the first documents we have talking about the Roman Republic is a treaty that Carthage signs, recognizing it as the legitimate government in Rome. It goes all the way back to 509. What you see is Rome and Carthage actually cooperate with each other with some regularity. When Pyrrhus of Epirus invades southern Italy, Carthage actually is a Roman ally in that conflict. And so these are two cities that are really powerful cities that have different kinds of ways of exercising that power. Rome has the most powerful army in the central Mediterranean. And Carthage has the most powerful navy in the central Mediterranean. And for the most part, that means that their interests don't collide because they're not interested in exerting power over similar things. But after the victory over Pyrrhus of Epirus, Rome has effectively come to control all of the Italian peninsula. And it begins looking to expand into some of the islands in the central Mediterranean, most importantly, Sicily. And this brings it eventually into conflict with Carthage. And so the First Punic War is a war in which a naval power that has the ability to fight on land but doesn't like to do it particularly, and a land power that doesn't really have the ability to fight on sea, somehow come into a conflict with each other over the islands in the central Mediterranean. And that conflict, of course, is devastating for both sides because they are, in a sense, rivals with very different skill sets. Carthage has the best navy in the central Mediterranean. Rome doesn't really know how to fight naval battles against an adversary that's that strong. And so Rome is continually building fleets that get destroyed or get sunk, and that's very expensive. And the First Punic War is incredibly taxing economically for the Roman Republic. But what you see is, again, Rome has decided to do this, and more or less the people making decisions in the Republic follow the same path that Appius Claudius had advertised and had advised against Pyrrhus of Epirus. You know, if they're going to commit to this struggle, they must actually commit to this struggle. And Rome, which is much less wealthy than Carthage, probably pours much more of its wealth relative to its economy, or the size of its economy, into providing fleets and fighting this war than Carthage did. And ultimately, Rome has a higher tolerance for the expense and cost of that war than Carthage does, and Rome ends up winning the First Punic War. But what follows the First Punic War is something that is particularly disreputable, and even Romans can't actually even come up with an explanation for why Rome behaved as it did. Because Rome gets control of Sicily after the First Punic War. And then the islands of Sardinia and Corsica, which Carthage retained control over, rebel. And they appeal to Rome. And Rome then redeclares war on Carthage, simply so that it can take these two islands. And Carthage is not in a position to defend itself against Rome, and Rome steals these two islands from Carthage. One of the people who was particularly aggrieved at Roman behavior in this context is, well, a young man named Hannibal. And as Hannibal comes through the ranks, he eventually gets control over Carthaginian forces in Spain. It becomes very clear, and our sources generally agree, that Hannibal hated the Romans. He found them to be absolutely disreputable, dishonorable, and intolerable. And Hannibal more or less goads Rome into declaring war against Carthage, and then shocks Rome by invading Italy. And the first 3 years of Hannibal's campaigns in Italy are utterly devastating for the Romans.
And he goes through the Alps,
Hannibal,
right?
Yeah. I mean, what the Romans had expected is they would confront Hannibal in Spain, or maybe what's now southern France. And they send a force out to confront him in what's now Provence. And what Hannibal manages to do is move quickly, avoid that force, and then go through the Alps and show up in northern Italy. Rome is shocked, and Hannibal's goal was really to provoke Rome into fighting pitched battles against him, and hopefully pulling some of Rome's support in Italy away from it by showing that Rome couldn't defeat him. And Rome falls into this trap three times. And the most serious defeat was in central Italy, out in an area called Cannae, where Rome overall loses almost 100,000 people. And to put this into perspective, in the three battles that Rome lost to Hannibal in 218, 217, and 216 BC, it lost probably 35% of the fighting men in its entire population. You know, this would be over 100,000 men killed in those 3 years, more men than the United States has lost in combat collectively since World War II. And Rome is confronted then with an economy that is collapsing, a population that is rapidly being depleted, and Hannibal one day's march from the city. And this is the moment when you really see the strength of the Roman Republic. When Appius Claudius was telling Rome to keep fighting, this was in some level a theoretical exercise. You know, if they had made peace with Pyrrhus, Pyrrhus would have left and Rome would have been intact. Hannibal is a day's march from the city of Rome. Panic has set in the city of Rome because of the number of people who've been killed. And what the Republic then has to decide to do is, how do you respond to this situation? And the remarkable thing about it is the Republic reaches a consensus that it will do the ancient equivalent of mounting a total war against Hannibal. And that means that industrial activity will go towards making weapons. It means that the food supply to the city of Rome is going to be not particularly secure. It means that nearly every military age man will now serve in the army. It means that you will go from having a few legions to maybe 25 legions. It means that you will be fighting in Greece. It means you'll be fighting in Libya. It means you'll be fighting in Tunisia. It means you'll be fighting in Spain.
I mean, this sounds like a world war.
You'll be doing this for as long as it takes.
Yeah, it sounds like a world war.
It is it's the equivalent of, say, what the Soviet Union does in World War II. It is the entire society rearranges itself to fight Hannibal. And there is a consensus to do this and to accept whatever costs the society will have to bear. And that's something that a republic can do that most societies cannot. And to Rome's great credit, it does this for 15 years until Hannibal is finally defeated.
I was riveted in reading this part in your book, Mortal Republic, because having a war like this, and I think this is part of the lesson, inevitably changes the Republic. And you even have one line, and it's just one line that's actually in between parentheses, that you compared it to the United States post-World War II.
Yeah.
How did the Punic Wars change the nature of the Roman Republic?
the victory over Carthage, it helps generate an economic revolution that creates tremendous and very rapidly advancing wealth inequality in Rome. And so the weird legacy of the Second Punic War is Roman society that is simultaneously both more wealthy and also in some ways less stable.
And more unequal?
Absolutely. And I think the important thing for us to understand is that there is in absolute terms, economic inequality in that society, but there's also a sense of unequal opportunity. And this is, I think, something that's important for us to understand because it's something I think we're confronting now as well. In the aftermath of the Second Punic War, Hannibal had killed so many Italians and had devastated so much Italian land that there was a lot of space and opportunity for people in Rome to basically rebuild their society. And so if we look at the demographics of Italy after the Punic Wars, what we tend to see is there's a baby boom that rapidly replenishes the Italian population. But for two generations, there's ample land and a lot of jobs and a lot of well-paying jobs for all of those new Romans and all of those new Italians to feel like they're doing better than their parents, to feel like they're more prosperous, and to feel like there are opportunities that they are realizing. But right about the time that the Roman financial sector starts taking off and these examples of really extravagant and ostentatious displays of wealth start coming in, that opportunity for regular Romans and regular Italians starts to dry up. And by the 150s, you have stories on the one hand of large villas by the seaside and banquets where guests are eating ostrich and flamingo tongues as delicacies, and parties where people are dissolving pearls in vinegar so that they can drink their wealth away. This is occurring at the same time that regular Italians and regular Romans are seeing their economic prospects stagnate, or in some cases even get worse than what their parents faced. And it's important to understand they're not starving. This isn't a widespread onset of poverty, but it's relative poverty, and it's a relative lack of opportunity. And it's occurring at the same time that the wealthy Romans are getting fabulously wealthy and displaying that wealth in ways that it's quite conspicuous, and it's quite difficult to take if you feel like you don't have the same opportunities that, say, your father had or your grandfather had.
And Edward J. Watts holds the Alcibiades Vassiliades Endowed Chair at UC Davis, where he teaches ancient history. He is the author of the book, Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny.